brights and in between the sheets, and the novels The Cement Garden, The Comfort of Strangers, which was recently made into a film with a screenplay by Harold Pinter, The Child in Time, and, as I said, the new book, The Innocent. Well, you've been a menacing writer for some time, and I began to wonder when I was reading The Innocent why it is that this particular version of the macabre seems so indigenous to that island of yours.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the issue of subject matter is one of the most recalcitrant in any kind of literary discourse. In part, I suppose it's a function of persuasion that I think, as human beings, if we're going to talk in those terms from your theme song, human animals, we have a dark side, and I find that the more interesting side to explore, partly to perhaps a function of my own personality, and it's beyond my control. That said, I mean, I think I'd hope that The Innocent would not simply suggest itself as a purely macabre book. I hope it's got many other tones. But it does have... it is written on the assumption that we are at the end of a bloody European century, and that the first half of that century witnessed acts of extraordinary cruelty and depravity, genocides and two major wars, and everything else that wars bring in their train. And in many ways, what happens in the novel, in its central scene, suggests, is meant to evoke that, and is meant to evoke the moral dread of violence. It's too easy to represent violence in commonplace and cynical ways. You know, someone fires a handgun, someone doubles up over the wound, and that's how violence seems to be represented everywhere we look. And I say it's cynical because we are not actually... no feeling is evoked.
Well, not to get off on the wrong track, and while I certainly know that the book has political and somewhat allegorical overtones, it does strike me that somewhere along the line, those Ealing comedies define a gesture that becomes one for Joe Wharton, that these lady killers who, or the Bolting Brothers things, have a certain tone of... I don't know what it is, merriment at the threat of death, and perhaps merriment after the threat of death, that I can't, you know, they're always talking about the bizarre German sense of humor, which I don't find quite so bizarre as this particular strain of humor, which seems 20th century, very British, and like other things of the century, to begin in pop culture, to seem to begin, in a way, this attitude with the movies, with Hitchcock on the one hand, and those crime comedies on the other. Perhaps the figure of Alistair Sims is the tutelary deity here.
Yeah, I mean, popular culture is one way of talking about this, because the novel... is interested in the beginnings of popular culture in the terms of which our generation came to know and appreciate it. So this young guy Leonard is one of his initiations is into rock and roll in its earliest stages, and into the idea of youth culture, which revolts him. It appalls him and yet fascinates him too. I suppose that there comes a point in this book, and perhaps in many of my other books, where I want people to be both, to be giggling in the dark, I suppose, because I think that's what we're doing at this end of the millennium. A lot of us are having a very good time with a sense that it's not going to last. you don't feel that more anywhere in the world than in L.A.
Well, as the bagpipe player in this novel says, after a while, a lament is a very good thing.
Yeah, there's nothing quite like a lament. Yeah, well, you need laments, but you also you need a bit of tension around them too.
The Innocent is a book that takes a British technician to Berlin in 1955. The book tells us many times an innocent. What is he innocent of?
Well, first of all, he's innocent sexually, although gaining sexual experience is not, for me, as far as I'm concerned, the end of innocence. That's one of those false literary lines that I've never really believed in. The idea that people become wise after their first sexual experience is, to me, both a banal and absurd idea.
Well, I think what happens is most people realize that they'll never learn how to fly.
Right. what else is he in? There's an innocence in Leonard which I think is of a rather appalling nature. Not all innocence is wonderful. There is a kind of innocence that is a refusal to accept responsibility. I remember President Carter giving a speech many years ago when the hostages were taken in Iran, and he said, "Now America has lost its innocence." And I realize how enduring that myth of American innocence is.
Yes, America has lost its innocence again.
Yeah. It was Gertrude Stein who said that America was the oldest country in the 20th century, and I think she was right. And by the mid-70s, she was a very old country in the 20th century, with Vietnam and two world wars and fingers in a squillion pies. So there's that kind of innocence, which is the innocence that says, why does everyone act upon me, and fails to see just how you yourself are acting on everybody else. That's an innocence that Leonard never quite loses throughout the book.
There's a kind of world weariness in your books. I've always kind of wondered about your roués. Seem very aware that they are roués, and the narrative representation of the character seems to be very self-aware that it won't take very many brushstrokes to do this kind of character, at least not at first. And so the woman here who, although I saw no evidence of it in the book, a recent reviewer said that she looks exactly like Marlene Dietrich.
Yeah, where did he get that idea from?
I think he gets the idea from the fact that the role, that is the role, at least the one she begins in. Mm. And I've noticed that in many cases there are sort of a priori types that your people sort of depart from. I wondered if you'd talk about that, the sort of initial situation that comes perhaps from the movies, better movies, not junky movies, but, you know.
I'm not quite sure how to talk about that, because movies actually haven't played a huge role in my interior life, even though I now write them. Well, I suppose, again, one of the tragedies of our consciousness now is that we'll watch our demise with an exquisite regard. We'll watch ourselves go down, and we'll document it brilliantly. There'll be great poetry. There'll be superb scientific research to chart the global warming. There'll be great novels about the end of the human race. We'll witness ourselves with probably all the highest elements of our own civilization, while our civilization is taking us down. And I suppose perhaps that is an element of how my characters are. They know what they are. And they can... I like to paint them quickly, with small strokes, partly because, and this reviewer we just mentioned vindicates this, readers will paint them anyway. They'll fill them in. They'll do all the work of the production design. I'm not interested in filling pages with notes, nudges, and telling you how people dress and look. What else is there to say? I can't agree with you about them being roués, though.
Well, I think in The Comfort of Strangers, for instance, there is, here he comes, the mysterious stranger with perversion on his mind. And we know when he makes his way onto the page that his non sequiturs and his, you know, cynicism brand him as a certain kind of character.
But we don't know what he's going to do, and we don't know where he's from, we don't know what he wants.
But we never know those things. That character always appears trailing boxcars of mysterious origin, and, you know...
Well, he's obliging up to a certain point. You must forgive him this, that he sat down in the bar with his victims and gave them a blow-by-blow account in down-the-line Freudian terms of his boyhood and his time with his sisters. And there's enough suggestion, from my point of view, that actually he's a product of his victim's state of mind. That he grows, he's like a genie. He's rubbed out of all the staleness and hopelessness of a relationship that's coming to an end. This is the kind of corrupt doppelganger who comes up like a cloud of smoke and turns into a guy.
I'm talking to Ian McEwan, the author of The Innocent, a novel just recently published by Doubleday. This book has, to its advantage, the sudden tearing down of the Berlin Wall to kind of make still more interesting the events in its first 250 pages, and the last chapter takes us up to a current Berlin. As you were writing the book, did you begin to feel that the nature of this novel would be changed by history, how it would be read and seen?
No, I was quite innocent of that. I finished in June, and the very last line is Leonard thinking he must get to the wall and look at it before it gets torn down. And the wall came down in November. I had the proofs then. I could have tampered with them. I could have actually had Leonard go through the wall, as I was doing it myself at Potsdamer Platz on November the 12th. But I decided to leave it all in place. I knew that the wall was going to come down. Everybody knew that. And most people thought, the best guess in the middle of 89 was that Honecker would die and Gorbachev would lean on the GDR, Communist Party, to elect a liberal guy who would slowly come around to Moscow's thinking. So I thought, like my desk clerk, I thought between 2 and 5 years. So it was an agreeable surprise. But the end was always restrained, I suppose partly because I did know that the wall would be down and this book would read differently. I knew that at some point, this period of time, 48, say, Berlin Airlift to the wall coming down, would be closed off.
Unlike the novel The Wall Jumper, which is full of a different kind of hijinks, your stuff always has cellars and tunnels, places where the unconscious, where the body is buried. And I was, you know, touched and moved to find a section from the great story, The Burrow, as an epigraph, the Kafka. And it seems to me that in your work there is a kind of war between the restraint of the writing surface and the enormity of the unconscious waiting to receive whatever body is sent there by the restrained and the reticent British nature of the characters. Do you consider yourself a writer from the unconscious?
Yes, I think I do. And yet in the writing, day on day, I have to live at the surface. If you're going to draw on the unconscious, you have to ignore it. Otherwise, it falls apart in your hands and becomes a trick, becomes a gimmick. So I write in a state of, let's say, artificial innocence about this. I spend my time pushing and pulling and fingering sentences. I read aloud to myself. I spend my time working on that surface, knowing that if I work well and honestly, other things will begin to force the logic of those paragraphs into shape. So often I find patterns there in the book at the end which seem all too clear, which just put themselves there. For example, I didn't know the book was called The Innocent, and you yourself mentioned parenthetically that we're told this many times, but I was not really aware of telling anyone that many times. And for a long time I wanted to call the book something else, till everyone said, The Special Relationship.
One of my favorite things, actually, about the book is the way in which the construction ongoing of this tunnel between the American sector and the German sector of Berlin in 1955, involving the tapping of Russian phone lines, becomes, as it's told, the shape of the unconscious of the hero, Marnum. Who is having all of these new experiences, his first sexual experience. And so this burrowing forward becomes a sexual metaphor, and then guilt gets incorporated there, too. I like the way in which the literal surface of the plot becomes the metaphoric surface of the unconscious in the novel.
It's a giant train set, too. It's not only the things you mention. There is a sort of level stretch in the book where Leonard is comfortably in love, he's about to get engaged, and the tunnel is working. And when Leonard goes back to England for Christmas, he misses his girl, but he misses the tunnel more than anything. And I've often thought that it's something peculiar about men and machines and gadgets. If you walk up and down the Tottenham Court Road in London, which is where they sell hi-fis and CDs and fax machines, you'll see a lot of rather lonely-looking guys with their faces pressed to the plate-glass window. And you know that somehow gadgets and electronic gimmicks fill something in for them that perhaps should be filled in by, you know, a girlfriend or some human contact. And for Leonard, I think there is there's a little bit missing of him in him. And the tunnel fulfills that, too. I think a lot of the Cold War and all this obsession with weaponry has got something to do with a deficiency on a mass scale in the human mentality, which I associate, I'm afraid to say, largely with men.
The reviewer in the New York Times, I thought, was at his best when he suggested that the villain in your work is male sexuality.
Yes, although I would say the real villain, that's just a minor villain. The real villain is failure of imagination. In writing the book, I began to feel that perhaps all human cruelty, how we are a wolf to our fellow men, could be derived from ideas about the failure of imagination. To fail to imagine that other people are as real as you are seemed to be one of the things that brings Leonard to attempt to rape his girlfriend, for example. And so when she brushes him off and has her own memory of witnessing a far worse scene, which actually has historical reality, the idea there is suddenly you see the great gap between fantasy and failed imagination and the historical reality of cowering in a bunker in 1945 when a Russian soldier first encounters German civilians.
I've been talking to Ian McEwan, author of The Innocent, recently published by Doubleday. After a brief interlude, we'll be talking to John Banville, author of The Book of Evidence. My second guest today is John Banville, who I'm talking to in New York. He's visiting America from Dublin, where he lives and edits the Irish Review. I first encountered John Banville's books, 17 years ago, when a book came into my hand called Night's Pawn. I was dazzled by it, a kind of creepy and exciting book, full of intellectual and aesthetic energy, and his novels have been coming out steadily since. Four of them remain in print from David Godin, an estimable publisher who keep a lot of interesting writers in print, and his most recent book, The Book of Evidence, was published recently by Scribner's. Is it disturbing to you, having written a book on Kepler, a book on Copernicus, a novel called The Newton Notes, to have a novel which is a first-person narrative by a murderer be the book that's getting so much attention and so suddenly?
Yes, it's a little bit of a puzzle, I suppose. But I don't think of it as a book narrated by a murderer. I think of it as a book narrated by a man who committed a murder. I think that there is a difference. I think that Freddie Montgomery, my hero, or at least my protagonist, is more of an artist than a killer. He's puzzled by his own actions.
In certain ways, when I was reading the book, I thought of it as a book about the consequences of aestheticism, or how to put it, what happens when someone has nothing more to do than to organize his life aesthetically, the dangers that then come about when he faces that abstraction of happiness called money.
Yes, certainly, I mean, all my books, in a way, have been about people who are obsessed in one way or another, who have what Wallace Stevens calls the rage for order, the rage to find some ordered method to impose on a chaotic and frightening world. Freddie, at one stage, has been a scientist, or at least a budding scientist, and he gave that all up. I'm frankly not quite sure why something happened to him and he gave it up. And he drifts, and he finds the drift frightening, but he can't get out of that spiral of drift until he commits this very violent crime, which seems in a way the book of evidence itself is an effort on Freddie's part to understand how he could come to this point in his life.
John Banville's The Book of Evidence is his seventh novel. Now, it seems to me, I guess I've been one of the lucky few Americans who've been keeping track of you. It seems to me that you're such an extraordinary writer. How have they managed to hide you under whatever stone it is you've been hidden?
Great skill. They brought my books out at dead of night in case anybody might find out about it. I think people are put off, and I understand it to some extent, by novels which have titles like Dr. Copernicus, Kepler, The Newton Letter. People are... I think they feel, oh, the hell with it. When I read a novel, I want to read fiction. I want to read entertainment. I don't want to read about these real people who led difficult lives and did difficult things. Most people who do actually read the books discover that it's not quite like that. Kepler, in particular, I think, was an extremely sympathetic character, a really splendid man, a splendid human being. I fell in love with him a little. But I can see that people would be frightened by the notion of a book about a scientist.
The books are full of splendid irony and humor, and it seems, at least in the Book of Evidence, that a tutelary deity is Vladimir Nabokov. At one point, Freddy notices in a car trunk an orange pullover left there perhaps by a superior maker, and Nabokov's heroes were always finding stray bits of old VN's logic for them, often in car trunks, too.
Yes, it is, I suppose, Nabokovian. I was, in fact, worried when I started the book that people would criticize it as being a sort of a pale version, you know, son of Lolita. I think that anybody who writes from a prison cell with, as Humbert says himself, you can always trust a murderer for fancy prose style. Anybody who writes from prison style with a fine, high style is going to be compared to Humbert. My concerns in the Book of Evidence obviously are very different to the Nabokov's, but I do admire him greatly. And I have, to some extent, given Freddie in my book a kind of Humbertian eye for the world.
And a great gift for phrase making.
Yes, Freddie likes a fine phrase. There is a deeper aspect to it, I think, but in a way, the entire book is, to some extent, Freddie's effort to redeem himself, or at least to atone for the disaster of his life and the disaster of taking someone else's life. It is an effort to teach himself how to imagine things, because only by imagining things can he make them be there vividly, as he didn't. He says at one point that he feels that perhaps his real crime wasn't killing the person that he killed, but failing to imagine her strongly enough to make her be real enough that he would be unable to kill her.
A final question. Freddie's visit to his mother in Ireland, the home of his youth, had memories for me of Molloy's similar visit in fellow Irishman's early novel, Molloy, first of the trilogy. Have you affection and mourning for the passing of Samuel Beckett?
I think Beckett was one of the very great people of the century. You hear how dreadful how one falls into cliche talking about these people, but when we strain to talk about people whom we have great regard for, this is what happens. He was, I think, a very great man, and I was very pleased to hear from his publisher and from a couple of other people who were with him in his last weeks that the last thing he was reading was the Book of Evidence. I feel as if something has been passed on, a baton has been passed on in a race.
I've been talking to John Banville, whose most recent book, The Book of Evidence, has been published by Scribner's. I'd also like to pay tribute to a press in Massachusetts called Godine, which, among many other fine books, has kept four of John Banville's books in print, in paperback. This is Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books, to the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.